We're on page 3 of the outline, down through 2B. We spent most of last week discussing 2, the evolution of the treaty form and its implications for the dated book of Deuteronomy. And under that, we looked at A and B, which was a closer look at both the Assyrian treaties, those of Esarhaddon, and the Aramaic treaties, which is B, from Sapiri, and comparing the structure format of those treaties with the Hittite treaties. And I think that's where we stopped after B5, conclusion, after looking at the Aramaic treaties. Does that agree with what you have? Anybody's? We didn't discuss C, the implications, the final...
The
implications of the treaty covenant.
Talk more about Thompson.
Yeah, okay. Okay. All right, I guess you're right. I do recall that. In other words, I, on that conclusion, said that Klein does have good reason to talk of the evolution of the treaty form.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
You got it from 5, 8, 4, 3.
Okay, yeah. But then that brings us to this other thing of Thompson, because you are reading Thompson, and in his book, in the Tyndale series, pages 51 and 52, he expresses some reservations about Klein's conclusion. He himself then, we'll look at that a little bit further, but he himself then argues for a date of Deuteronomy in the 11th to 10th centuries B.C., which would be the period of Solomon and David. He sees Moses behind the work, but feels editorial processes have brought it to the point where, in the form we have it now. So, as far as Thompson's book is concerned, he certainly is not advocating the Wellhausen sort of 7th century, 621 kind of date. It's either Solomon David's time and substantial parts of it, even Mosaic, but editorial processes involved. His reservations about Klein's view, I think, are basically 2. One is that in his view, he feels that Deuteronomy could have been put in the shape of the treaty form by someone writing long after Moses' time. You see, that's the bottom paragraph there on page 51. The possibility must be allowed that Deuteronomy was cast in the shape of an ancient treaty by someone who wrote long after Moses' day. Now, in that view, Thompson's the basic thesis there is not much different than that of both a man named Frankina. I believe it's on your bibliography. If you look at page 4 of your bibliography, R. Frankina, Vassal Treaties of Esarhaddon and the Dating of Deuteronomy. In that article, Frankina argues dependence, particularly of the treaty curses in Deuteronomy 28, on Assyrian treaty curses, and feels that that is something that is an argument for a late date of Deuteronomy. It's put in that treaty terminology and expression at a late time. Frankina argued that, and also Moshe Weinfeld. I mentioned that last week, I believe. In Moshe Weinfeld's book, Deuteronomy and the Deuteronomic School, that's this book, he feels that the treaty form in Deuteronomy is to be ascribed to court scribes in the time of Hezekiah and Josiah, so that the form was imposed on the material at a late date. Now, Thompson doesn't go that late. down to Hezekiah or Josiah. But in principle, you see, what he's saying is the possibility has to be open that the shape of the treaty form is given to Deuteronomy by somebody living long after the time of Moses. So that's one thing he says. Another thing, in opposition to Klein's argument, has to do with the historical prologue. And Thompson says that the historical prologue argument is not strong because, now what is the historical prologue argument? The historical prologue argument was the Assyrian treaties and the Aramaic treaties don't have one. The Hittite treaties do. And that's one of the contrasts. It's not the only contrast, but one of the contrasts. And certainly it's an important contrast because it affects the tone and the character of the treaty as well as the treaty relationship. But he says that argument's not sound because the Assyrian and Aramaic treaties may either have, quote, assumed a prologue, or it may have been stated orally. In other words, you don't see it there, but he says maybe it was assumed. Of course, that's an assumption on his part. Or he says maybe it was stated orally. Maybe there was some oral previous history given before the conclusion of the treaty arrangement. And he suggests further that with the Aramaic treaties from Sapphiri, some of them are broken on the top. He says that maybe it was there in the broken section that we don't have anymore. So he tries to weaken that historical prologue argument in that way. And in addition, he claims evidence of a 7th century treaty text with a historical prologue. In other words, see, the turn the argument around. He finds evidence, he says, of a 7th century treaty text, which would be late, that does have a historical prologue. Now see, if you're going to argue then on the evolution of the treaty form, if the early treaties had a historical prologue, the late ones don't, then you come up with a late treaty that does have one, it weakens, of course, the argument of that evolution of the treaty form. But those are his basic arguments. See, at the end of the page he says, but in fact, on the top of page 52, there is a 7th century BC treaty where the historical prologue occurs. And in his footnote, he refers to A.F. Campbell and a historical prologue in the 7th century treaty text in Biblica. So in response to those two points of Thompson, first in response to that latter point, that text that he cites is a text that is disputed in itself. Whether that's a clear evidence of a historical prologue in a 7th century text is not so clear. There's another article, I think it's in your bibliography. This can get confusing because the article he cites is A.F. Campbell. There's an article by an E.F. Campbell. If you look on page 4 of your bibliography, they're right under each other. A.F. Campbell's the one he cites. Right under it, there's an article by an E.F. Campbell called Moses and the Foundations of Israel. And E.F. Campbell, in that article, says the text in question, the one that he's referring to, is very fragmentary, especially at the beginning. And the reading is far from clear, he says. So I haven't ever seen that text, but it's a disputable text, apparently. And then more recently, in the article you've been assigned to read by Kay Kitchen, which is basically an analysis of that book by Nicholson, Nicholson's book is God and His People, Covenant and Theology in the Old Testament. In Kitchen's analysis of that, page 132, note 37, he says, trying to see where that note comes from in the text, Yeah. Yeah, you see in the text, Kitchen in his conclusion says, the works of McCarthy and Weinfeld, on which Nicholson draws, obscure the clear differences between the 14th, 13th century treaties and the first millennium examples. The former treaties have, while the latter do not have, historical prologues. So again, you see it's that contrast. The early ones have it. Kitchen says the later ones do not have it. And then he puts this footnote. He says, the supposed trace of the treaty in the Treaty of Ashurbanipal and Kedar is not a prologue. After the now lost title and witnesses of the latter, a trace subsists. Just one historical allusion occurs, used to clarify and justify Ashurbanipal's dispositions that follow. So Kitchen there is also arguing that this appeal that Thompson makes to the occurrence of a historical prologue in a 7th century text is really not a historical prologue. So I'm not so sure that point that he makes there has good foundation. The other basic point that he makes, that someone cast Deuteronomy in the shape of the treaty form long after Moses' time. That's, of course, possible. You can't rule that out. It's possible that that could have happened. It seems to me very unlikely that that's a good explanation for the shape of Deuteronomy. And certainly that doesn't disprove Klein's thesis. It gives you another model, but it certainly doesn't disprove Klein's thesis that the thing should be Mosaic because the materials to which it most closely corresponds come from the Mosaic era. I think that remains the strongest argument for Klein to say, well, it's been cast in that form by somebody much later. Anybody can make assertions like that, but certainly he can't prove that. And it seems to me the weight of the evidence goes the other direction. Yeah.
Why would somebody write such an ancient form?
That's exactly the point. Yeah.
But why does he have to seem to push Dr. Deuteronomy?
I don't know. I've wondered that myself. It surprises me that he does. Because generally, he's fairly conservative in his views. I don't know what is the decisive factor for him. There's one other thing that he mentions that I'll come back to in a minute, and that's what he calls post-Mosaic in Deuteronomy. That may be another factor. But those have been questions that I think have been adequately discussed. I don't think it should force him. I don't know why he goes that direction, because it seems to me that the weight of the evidence points the other direction. So it seems to me those two points, you know, the prologue argument and the possibility that someone cast Deuteronomy in the shape of the treaty form long after Moses' day, really don't give him a very strong case against the Mosaic origin. Klein comments in his Structure of Biblical Authority, page 10. He says this, if it is once recognized that the Deuteronomic Treaty must have been produced whole for a particular occasion, the pervasive orientation of the book to the situation of Israel in the Mosaic Age, and especially the central concern of this treaty with, of all things, the dynastic succession of Joshua, always awkward for advocates of a 7th century origin of the book, become quite inexplicable for them. I think he's right in that. If somebody's going to push it later, why such involvement with this thing of the succession of Moses and Joshua? It's appropriate for the time in which it represents itself to have been written. McConville, you're reading his book, Law and Theology, Deuteronomy, discusses this matter of the treaty form as well. And in his conclusion to his entire book, page 159, he says this, a final word is in place on the treaty form of Deuteronomy. We saw that the linguistic connections between chapters 1 to 11 and 12 to 18, as indeed the formal parallel between chapter 7 and 12, serve to point up the relationship between Yahweh's action on Israel's behalf in chapters 1 to 11 and Israel's response to that action in chapters 12 to 18. See, 1 to 11 is, broad term, basically that historical material and the basic stipulation, whereas 12 to 18 is Israel's obligation. So what he's saying is, in the first 11 chapters, you have Yahweh's action, and then in 12 to 18, you have Israel's response. He says, this shows that the discernment of the treaty form Deuteronomy is not a matter of identifying the extent of the various constituent parts of the treaty. Rather, the action-response characteristic of the treaty is found to be represented at a deep level in the language of the book. We expressed doubt at an earlier stage of our study whether the recognition of a form more or less equivalent to that of the Hittite treaties was really compatible with the belief necessitated by the Deuteronomistic theory that that form was only arrived at in the later stages of the book's composition, around the time of the exile. We have found a number of reasons to challenge that theory in a fundamental way. It seems to the present author that Deuteronomy studies should in the future pay attention once again to the implications of treaty form, which clearly have not been exhausted. Rather than continue to seek the key to an understanding of the book in a theory which cannot survive close scrutiny. So that's McConville's comments on this whole question. And then just one final quote, and that is from K.A. Kitchen's other article that you are reading, called Ancient Orient Deuteronomism and the Old Testament, in the volume New Perspectives on the Old Testament, edited by J. Barton Payne. And on page 4 of that article, Kitchen says, the present writer cannot see any legitimate way of escape from the crystal clear evidence of the correspondence of Deuteronomy with the remarkable stable treaty or covenant form of the 14th to 13th centuries BC. Two points follow here. First, the basic structure of Deuteronomy and much of the content that gives specific character to that structure must constitute a recognizable literary entity. Second, this is a literary entity not of the 8th or 7th century, but rather from about 1200 BC at the latest. Those who so choose may wish to claim that this or that individual law or concept appears to be of later date than the late 13th century BC, but it is no longer methodologically permissible Galley to remove essential features of the covenant form on a mere preconception, especially of 19th century AD vintage, of what is merely thought, not proven, to be late. In other words, again, he's challenging the whole Wellhausen, ever since Wellhausen, idea of analysis in the book of Deuteronomy on the basis of the treaty structure or form. Now, Thompson's reservations, first of all, he questions, as I've mentioned, this strength of Klein's argument on the treaty covenant analogy. But then he also speaks of some other things that make him conclude that the book is not Mosaic. And he cites two arguments that have long been used by advocates of a late date to Deuteronomy. And those are, first, this is on page 52. First is that passages in the prophets reminiscent of Deuteronomy don't prove that the prophets knew Deuteronomy. It's possible that Deuteronomy was based on the prophets. In other words, you find certain similarities of language. There seems to be a connection between certain sections in prophetic books and the book of Deuteronomy. And of course, the argument has often been made, well, Deuteronomy was first. The prophets reflect their familiarity with Deuteronomy. And he says, those passages don't prove the prophets knew Deuteronomy. It's possible Deuteronomy was based on the prophets, and the prophets first, Deuteronomy comes later. Well, again, I think all that's shown by that is how difficult an argument that is to use, to prove priority. Whether it's with the prophets in Deuteronomy or between, you know, often you find allusions between two passages that you find similar. Take the passage in Obadiah and the one in Jeremiah about Edom. And that's been argued both ways. Some say Obadiah is dependent on Jeremiah because the language is so similar. Others say Jeremiah is dependent on Obadiah. It's a very hard argument to make one way or the other with any kind of conclusiveness. But so again, I don't know why he says the argument's not conclusive, for these parallels do not necessarily prove the 8th century prophet's new Deuteronomy, either in its developing form or its final form. Well, I think that's true, but I think that the whole argument is a very difficult one to use in any kind of conclusive way. Yeah. I don't think he would. It was later. That's my guess. But again, he's actually saying that even, you know, if this is in time of Solomon or David, United Kingdom, it is pretty prophetic. So he's not arguing against that. But he's arguing against those who use this analogy. He's really just showing that this argument is not a conclusive argument. I wouldn't take issue with him on that. It fits with a Mosaic date, but I don't think you can prove a Mosaic date that way. Okay? In his large commentary on Deuteronomy?
No, in his commentary on Jeremiah.
I meant on Jeremiah, excuse me. Yeah.
Trying to piece it all together and how this futuristic school affected Jeremiah.
Yeah. I've looked at that commentary, I haven't read it carefully. I'm not sure what he means by that. You know, that terminology is used in so many different ways. How he is defining Deuteronomistic school, I'm not sure. If he is saying there were those around who were influenced by the book of Deuteronomy, who in turn influenced the language of Jeremiah and the book of Jeremiah, that's no problem.
No problem.
No, I think...
How Jeremiah was far from qualified.
Yeah. But the question you see is, which way is the influence going? Did Jeremiah influence the writing of the book of Deuteronomy? In other words, was his preaching that which helped develop this Deuteronomistic school who then produced Deuteronomy? Or is it that Deuteronomy's influence came down through the centuries and helped structure the language of Jeremiah? It seems to me that, you know, there's no problem with that if that's what he means by it. But I'm not certain. I would think that's what he means by it. But the second thing he says is that there are post-Mosaic additions to the book. This is further down on page 52, he says, if a Mosaic authorship is accepted, the question arises as to what place then must be allowed to post-Mosaic additions. Some of those who contend for Mosaic authorship place these at a minimum. Clearly, the account of the death of Moses, chapter 34, must be post-Mosaic. Some of the geographical expressions in the book are of particular interest from this point of view. Apparently, the land of Canaan is viewed from outside. The expression beyond Jordan has often been taken as a post-Mosaic expression because it appears to imply that a speaker is standing in Palestine. He admits then later on the expression beyond the Jordan might mean in the region of Jordan. See, that's the end of the page. The expression therefore often lacking in definition. I think that's true. I don't think you can make an argument from that geographic expression beyond the Jordan in a conclusive kind of way that it must be post-Mosaic. Nor does the thing that the account of Moses' death is included in the book of Deuteronomy disturb me greatly. I have no objection to that being appended at the end of the book after Moses' death. I mean, the whole book is leading up to that. And to put a final note there that tells you that, yes, he did die, doesn't seem to me to be a major difficulty with accepting the Mosaic origin of the book. That beyond the Jordan expression, let's look at that a little closer. It occurs quite a few places, sometimes with reference to the, clearly in context, to the eastern side of the Jordan. In other words, what we know as Transjordan. For example, already in the first chapter, this is why the thing has been discussed quite a bit. See, in Deuteronomy 1:1, these are the words which Moses spoke unto all Israel. King James says, on this side of the Jordan. In the Hebrew, that's Be'er HaYarden. You see, some have translated that then, these are the words which Moses spoke unto all Israel beyond the Jordan. Beyond. Where did he speak the words of the book of Deuteronomy? Yeah, in the plains of Moab. And if that says he spoke it beyond the Jordan, here's the Jordan, there's the plains of Moab, it sounds like the viewpoint of the author you see is over here, on the west side of the Jordan. And you have that used in 1:1-5, again, King James says on this side of the Jordan, in the land of Moab, but it's the same expression. It's in 441, 446, etc. However, to counter that, it occurs in 320, same expression, of the western side. See, 320, till the Lord has given rest unto your brethren as well as unto you, and until they also possess the land which the Lord your God hath given them, Be'er HaYarden, beyond the Jordan. And then shall ye return every man to his possession which I have given you. That's speaking of the land given to the 2.5 tribes that were going to stay in the east. But it's talking about those going to the west. And beyond the Jordan there is the other way. That's 320 and 25. Let me go over and see the land that is beyond the Jordan. That goodly mountain in Lebanon. That's clearly speaking of the western side from the standpoint of here, it seems. But then what even makes this more confusing, look at 3. And I think that's why, so you see why, I'm not even certain why he uses these arguments. That's why he says expression is often lacking in definition. It's a very hard thing to pinpoint. And what is even more interesting is it's used 24 times in the Old Testament, this expression, Be'er HaYarden, 24 times in the Old Testament with a qualifying clause such as towards the sea, That would be beyond the Jordan towards the sea, which would mean west. Or towards the sun rising. Beyond the Jordan towards the sun rising, which would mean the east. In other words, those qualifying clauses added to it indicate that the phrase itself is not decisive with respect to place of the speaker. It seems like it's a rather ambiguous phrase. It seems like you just have to translate it depending on the context. Like in chapter 3, it's clear on the one reference in 8 referring to one side and the other reference referring to the other. And you can't then base much on the standpoint of the writer from looking at the use of that expression. So why is it that Thompson is arguing against Mosaic Day? I'm not too sure, because I don't think his arguments against the treaty form are conclusive. And to bring up the death of Moses and this kind of an expression, the things have been discussed a long time, they're not conclusive either. But in any case, he argues against Mosaic Garden.
You mentioned that the region of the Jordan?
Something like that. I think that.
Because the root doesn't necessarily mean on the other side. It could mean by going through. Isn't that the same type of root that I.
Of our means to cross over. Yeah. It's like the crossing of the Jordan, something like that. The region of the Jordan. It seems that it's simply a phrase that has reference to the Jordan, but it can be used from either standpoint to refer to almost like almost like Transjordan, but applying it to this side or that side depending on the context. Yes. Just the place, and it doesn't seem like it's a place. It seems like it's referring to the region, either on one side of the Jordan or the region on the other side of the Jordan. Well, I don't think Thompson's case is convincing, and as far as I'm concerned, that treaty covenant analogy remains a forceful new argument for Mosaic Day. I don't think it's proof. I think we can talk in terms of proof. But I think it gives a forceful new argument that wasn't around 20 years ago, 25 years ago, for Mosaic Garden. That's the argument. The interesting thing is, and you pick this up from reading Kitchen's review of this book, Nicholson now has come along just recently, 85 or 6, 86, and denied the analogy altogether. That's the thesis of this book, that there isn't any analogy between the treaty form and the covenant form. Now, you read Kitchen's review of that. I don't want to get into the details of that. But he's questioned not just the date at which Deuteronomy acquired the treaty form, which Franken and Weinfeld and Thompson seem to be, the date at which it acquired the treaty form. But he questions the treaty covenant analogy itself and rejects it, and then wants to go back to the typical well-held thing that Deuteronomy said. And that even the idea of covenant didn't exist earlier. So it's interesting. Nicholson, yeah.
Yeah, Kitchen mentioned
everywhere you get the idea of covenant in Israel before the late days, that is retrojected back into earlier times. The idea itself did not exist at all. Yes, it goes right in the face of the Holy Evidence. It's interesting what scholars can do with arguments like that. Because that seems to me to be almost irrefutable. Kitchen makes that very clear. When you read this, you'll see it gives a good response. And apparently this is an initial response that he's going to elaborate on and make a much more thorough treatment. So. All right. Yes. Mendenhall. George Mendenhall, 1954, an article in the Biblical Archaeologist, drew the first attention to this parallel in structure between the Hittite treaties and the Biblical covenant.
As I was reading the Treaty of Great King, it seemed as though a lot of the criteria, or a lot of the points that were, I think that he had listed Collingwood, seemed to coincide with some of the things you had brought forth concerning the Assyrian treaty. I don't know if you have the book there.
Which book? Treaty of the Great King?
I don't know exactly where it is. It's in the early part of it, but it seemed as though some of the...
I think I know what you're getting at without looking at the book. If you go to, and that's part of Weinfeld's argument in a sense, if you go to some of the treaty curses, for example, Klein will cite from the Esarhaddon treaties some of the curses and show how close they are to the curses of Deuteronomy.
Yeah. Now,
if you have the Hittite treaties way back here, 1200, Assyrian treaties up here, say around 700, and then you find, say, a treaty curse in the Assyrian treaties that parallels Deuteronomy. Weinfeld argues and Franken argues, well, Deuteronomy borrowed from the Assyrian treaties because the wording is so close to the curses. What Klein counters to that is that formulations of things like curses, Kitchen does the same thing, it's on a visual. Formulations of things like curses become so stereotyped types of expression that the formulations continue on for centuries. So it's certainly possible that Deuteronomy can be back here and have the formulation of a curse that is very similar to something you find in the Assyrian treaty 700 years later because of continuity in the stereotyped expressions that you find in things like curses. And Kitchen illustrates that, for example, with Egyptian materials, where you find the same kind of phraseology demonstrably in texts that are centuries apart in time. So, but you see what you're talking about here is not the whole structure of the thing. You're talking about isolated elements within the structure where there may be a similarity. And it's true, you do find some similarities there of isolated things. But the parallel structure is here. They're part of the structure, but it's only one unit of the structure. Well, it's about six.
And the old aspect, I think, member of all referred to the old aspect, the responsibility of the says, and that's explicit in the series.
All right.
That's right.
Yeah.
Which, fine. Doesn't seem to do much with that. And I just wondered why, you know, if it is, if Mendel Holt didn't find it in the Hittite treaty.
I don't think you want to push these things too far as far as, forcing it to go on all fours with every. I mean, what you have in Deuteronomy compared to Hittite treaties is rather free use of. You've got similarities and differences. But the basic outline, structure of it, you find. As far as the oath aspect, Klein does feel that there is an oath with the Sinai covenant with the Deuteronomy. There's been some dispute on that, whether there is or there isn't. But you can, besides that, get into a whole definition of how you define it. There's a sense in which you can say that the whole covenant relationship itself, the covenant form, is a form of an oath. What is a covenant?
an elaborate form of an oath. There's sanctions involved. So, in a sense, the whole thing, you might say, the whole covenant arrangement is an elaborate form of oath. Israel repeatedly says, you know, whether it's at Sinai, where they said, yes, the Lord said we would do, that's an oath. Where they accepted this covenant that was given to them. And they do that again in Joshua 24. So I think you can find the oath early, but apart from that, you can take the whole thing as an oath. The whole arrangement as an oath. Covenant and oath are almost synonyms. No.
Jefferson says that the covenant idea consists of
In other cultures, that's what Kitchen's review says. It ignores all the evidence from other cultures because the use of that term is documented in all these other literatures very early on, and Nicholson ignores it. Yes.
Have you been found on two other things that says that the word Moses in the New Testament says, Moses says, may not just mean Moses, the person that comes to God, but on page 50 of the second commandment.
May not, what is that? Hence the term Moses may not refer specifically to authorship in every case, but may refer to the Pentateuch as a role called Moses. Oh, I see. Yeah. Well, to me that's grasping to it, because but the other two titles that he uses for the analogy, you know, the books group as writings and the books group as prophets, that doesn't suggest anything about authorship, or responsibility for material. There are a number of different books written by different writers in the writings and the prophets, but when it says Moses, it seems to me that they're in their assignment responsibility to an individual by name. Yeah, it makes more sense. Yeah. But the fact of the matter is, he just didn't say that. He said Moses. Yeah. Precisely, I would say. It goes against what he is suggesting. The last sentence is, the claim the servant made, Moses spoke certain words, and also that he wrote certain words, but it's extremely difficult to decide whether the words Moses recorded in Deuteronomy are his ipsissimo verba, or whether they are the report of Moses' words after they have passed through the process of transmission. Good place to take a break then. Let's come back and we'll move on to this question of centralization of worship.